You know, I always want to call you Danielle Sway. Do people do that to you?
No. Everyone at work calls me DW because I sign all my emails that way.
Really? I love a woman with initials.
Yeah.
So, Danielle Wiley, it's so nice to see you. You are the head of Sway, which is an influencer marketing agency. Yeah?
And then some. We've expanded in the last year or two. So we have our roots in influencer, and that's what we're really known for. But we have expanded into digital advertising, both programmatic and paid social, and we also have a content studio.
I can see that we're going to have a lot to talk about, and I'm going to try not to be intimidated because I know that you have also been a journalist. You have contributed to Forbes and The Atlantic and Wall Street Journal. And
it's so funny. I don't think of that. Like, I think of that as just part of my day job. But before I was doing this, I was a food writer and a restaurant critic. And I was like, oh, you're intimidated by my food writing?
Now I'm doubly intimidated. Holy moly. All right. Well, I'm E.B. Moss, and this is episode 32 of Insider Interviews. This is a podcast about folks in the media marketing and advertising industry. And as you can tell from the little preamble with my guest today, Danielle Wiley, I think we might hit all of those topics with one guest. So welcome, Danielle.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you. When's the last time you were on a podcast? I think this is old hat to you.
I had a run of them where I think it was at the beginning of COVID and I had to make a sign for the door, like recording podcast, but it's been a few months.
Oh, well, I'm happy to break you in again.
Yeah.
Yay. And the timing is a little tough personally for you. You're making a big move.
I am. We're moving from the Bay Area to Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Wow. All right. The university town. Okay.
Love a university town. We want to be closer to family. We got married there. We were married by the mayor of Ann Arbor back in the 90s. So we have some nice roots there.
Well, I'm from Princeton, another university town. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's nothing like it. So when you get there, Danielle, what's the first thing you're going to do?
I will probably go get a sandwich at Zingerman's Deli, as any good foodie would do.
Okay. Wow. So bring us back a little bit. Did you start with the food writing as your career? What happened? Who are you? What are you?
I had a wacky career. I was very interested in media and communications. I studied sociology, though, but they didn't have a communications or media major. I went to Vassar. So the only department that had any classes that touched on media was sociology. And so that's what I studied. And I did my thesis about daytime talk shows and left school wanting to do something in the communications space. Online was just becoming a thing. So my first job was for a literary PR agency, helping to rep a book called The Women's Guide to Online Services.
Oh.
And if you want to really date me, it covered CompuServe, The Well, Prodigy, and AOL.
Okay.
So that's kind of how I learned about it. And then I ended up at the Food Network, one of their first 50 staffers, helping with the business development department, just kind of jumping around. That's when I became a restaurant reviewer in Ann Arbor for the Ann Arbor News and did some general food writing as well. Worked at Zingerman's in their bakery, baking bread with a 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. shift. I was a cheesemonger at the produce station. I worked for M Live, which right now it's all the Michigan newspapers just living online. But then it was kind of the online site for the Ann Arbor News and all the other small papers throughout Michigan. And then finally kind of settled down in Toledo at an interactive agency where I stayed for 7 years and really got firmly entrenched in the agency space. And it was there that social media became a thing. Like, I remember sitting at my desk and creating a Facebook account. I started a food blog and couldn't help but make the connection between what I was doing and my clients. And my clients weren't super sexy consumer, you know, B2C clients. I was working with the largest cabinetry company, with Delta Faucet, which they're great faucets, but you don't think of them as having like a huge personality. But there just seemed to me that there was something there with mm-hmm. marketing, and this, it wasn't even called social media then, it was called Web 2.0. And so I started just teaching my clients about it and being like, here's this thing that's happening and you should know about it. And I don't know what you should be doing on it, but let's figure it out.
Okay. So I have so many things to say just about that first, I'm going to call it third or half of your career. The first is that I don't know what years you were at Food Network, but I was at Food Network.
You were. I was there in 96. And so I taught all the salespeople what banner ads were and how to sell them. And I didn't have an email address. I had to connect my computer via a cord and sign in with my AOL account to access it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also oversaw the fulfillment of their recipes, because back then you had to send in 99 cents and you got a printout of your recipes, and that oversaw that fulfillment center.
So you were also there at the time when the logo was the sort of butler serving dish. And I was there when my friend Heidi Diamond had taken it through the rebrand to the bright, splashy green in the Script Food. And this is actually interesting. She had worked on making chefs celebrities and influencers back then. And we called them chunks because they were chef hunks.
It was a big deal. My first day at the Food Network was an offsite at Chelsea Pier, where they announced that they were going to transition him to Emeril Live. And it was a huge, and that was the start of it. But I remember, now in hindsight, I remember walking into the break room and seeing girls sitting on Mario Batali's lap, which I now see in a different light. But meeting, to me, chefs were always kind of celebrities, but that was a big transition point in the media world.
Yes, and I don't know what we would call female hunks, but there were plenty of them, so everything became fairly balanced at Food Network, which I was happy to see. But I left right after 9/11, so you preceded me a little bit. And then what I also heard you say is that you were in Internet 101 and social media phase one, I should say. Yeah. And I think that this brings us to your present day skill set, which you were sort of influencer phase one. I think you've been in this industry since its get-go.
After I left the interactive agency in Toledo, I moved to Edelman in Chicago, and I was running strategy in the digital group there in Chicago. And because I was a food blogger, I'm saying blogger because back then it was just blogging. You didn't have, it wasn't influencer, Instagrammer. And so a lot of my friends were bloggers, and I could see what kind of engagement they were getting from their audience. And I could see the trust that they had. And in PR, you use spokespeople all the time. So, we would do a Huggies program and hire Tori Spelling to go to Times Square and participate in baby races. And I was seeing how much money they were paying for these celebrity spokespeople to do this work. And it was kind of mind-boggling to me, because no one thinks that Tori Spelling is their friend. And so you're missing that level of trust and engagement that I was seeing that the bloggers had. And I became determined to try to get as much work as possible over to these bloggers. So we brought three mom bloggers as honorary members of the Butterball Turkey Talk line one Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
We brought a bunch of mom bloggers to the Kraft headquarters to participate in kind of like a Chopped in the kitchens there and talk to R&D and share their thoughts. I remember trying to pitch Ree Drummond, Pioneer Woman, to the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and it was too soon. They just didn't get it.
Mm.
But yeah, so we kind of created it. And a lot of the influencer I'm making air quotes, a lot of the influencer work back then was unpaid, because whereas I kind of saw them as spokespeople, and now we understand that that makes a little bit more sense. In its infancy, influencers were treated more like journalists. Mm-hmm. And so the agencies and brands were just sending them product and letting them know about their services and expecting that they would get reviews out of it. And that worked for a short period of time, because if you've never received free stuff before and you're writing this food blog and all of a sudden all of these companies are sending you free product, it's exciting and you're going to write about it. But then eventually you realize no one's paying you and you're getting bombarded and expected to do all this work, and to what end? Mm-hmm. And on the brand and agency side, they realized, you know what, if we're just sending them a box of mac and cheese, we can't tell them what to say. We have no control over messaging. We have no control when this is going live. And so right in front of us, it transitioned from a journalist type of relationship to that of a spokesperson, and we started paying them.
So that also is the start of authenticity, meaning trust the, what we now call influencer, to create the content and not try to control it and allow them to be their authentic selves. And it also sort of shows us the shift from, I guess, celebrity endorsement. Tell us about the difference between hiring a Tori Spelling to endorse versus an influencer campaign.
Yeah, I think it's gotten so fuzzy now, because you have folks who are seen as influencers, but from my perspective, really fall more into the celebrity realm, like a Kylie Jenner or anyone in the Kardashian geek sphere.
Anyone with a K.
Anyone with a K. And some of these kids, I sound like I'm 85. Some of these kids on TikTok are becoming, if they're going to name a drink after you at Dunkin' Donuts, I think you've crossed over into celebrity out of influencer. The difference is, when you have that huge a following, the engagement goes down. You're going to get eyeballs, but there's a level of trust that's missing, which is what I said before, right? You don't necessarily believe that Kim Kardashian is using that toothbrush that she's talking about, or that Tori Spelling goes out and buys her own diapers. It feels more like an ad, and consumers are smart enough to see it as one. With influencers, especially in the nano and micro space, it's different. There's a level of trust. You really feel like you know these mm-hmm. people, and you kind of do. And because they're posting so frequently, you have this ambient awareness of their life. And I think you get enough of a sense of a person to know what's believable and what's not. And even on the business side, the negotiations are so much different. We do handle some celebrity work, and we'll negotiate that with managers and put those programs together. But it's structured so differently.
Well, let's go back, because you said you will do both, although Sway started, I guess, as primarily influencer before you expanded into all of these different areas. Talk about how you not only created this business, but what are the origins and where is it now? A little bit more deeper dive on Sway.
Yeah. So when I left Edelman to start Sway, it was with a very different business model. So we borrowed the business model of a manager or Hollywood agent, and we had 25 bloggers who we signed to our roster, and we got a percentage of any deal that we negotiated for them. And it was great because it was new and exciting, and we got awesome press. And actually, June marks our 10-year anniversary.
Congratulations.
And, you know, thank you. We launched with a bang. We had a big article in Ad Age with my picture, and it was a very exciting, sexy way to start. It was a terrible business model. What we realized were a few things. So Hollywood agents, when they negotiate a deal, that 10% that they get, or maybe 15% if it's a manager, that makes sense, because once that deal's negotiated, they leave and they don't have any more work to do. I don't know if it's that we're too type A, or we wanted our clients to come back. You know, I love the women we were representing. None of them were George Clooney, though. And so if they didn't get the work done on time or to the client specifications, and if they weren't able to provide the metrics, we wanted to be involved every step of the way to make sure that our clients got what they needed. We realized, so one, that small percentage was not enough to cover all of our work and leave any room for profit. The other thing we realized is that our clients needed to have access to a group of influencers that was much larger than that 25. So I always give the same example because it truly is the most bizarre request I ever had. We had a request for moms who shop at Kroger who have kids between the ages of 8 and 12 who still wet the bed. Try pulling that together.
I'm not laughing with you. Oh my.
So that was one thing. And then we needed volume. If we had a client with a big product launch, they might need 200 blog posts to go up in the course of a week, and we couldn't do that. So we ended up partnering with and then acquiring a network of influencers that was created not for monetization, but just to serve as a community for women who wanted to make their living in social media. So they were just supporting each other, learning, sharing best practices. It truly was a community. Mm. And so we met
almost an incubator of, of these micro influencers.
And they had a conference series where they would get together. So we met the founders of that and loved them. And they're now my two partners.
Oh.
Yeah. So we ended up acquiring that company and boom, we had 25,000.
I think that the proof is there because you were selected by Chief Marketer as one of just three influencer agencies for their 2020 Chief Marketer 200. So you're firmly on the map. Now, how have you added these additional legs that you mentioned at the top of our interview?
It's all grown super organically. So we added Content Studio first just because we would have clients who needed creative support beyond the influencer program. So for example, we did a program with Domino's and they are very strict about how the pizza looks and how the box looks. For obvious reasons, they wouldn't want any like stains at all. They don't want bubbles and, you know, whatever it is. So we handled all of the photography of the pizza with our content studio. And then our influencers handled all of, you know, showing themselves picnicking at the park and whatever you do when you're having pizza outside. So examples like that. What we learned is that there's so much more demand for content now. Brands have so much more demand. So they have an Instagram account and a Facebook account and a blog. I mean, there's just this constant demand for content. And so we realized that we knew what content resonated because of all of our experience in influencer. And we could take that same knowledge and create the content with our own creative team. And then the brand would have full ownership of it. And so that's how Content Studio.
That's brilliant. Started. I also want you to talk a little bit about some best practices. You and I sort of met each other through a publication called The Continuum. I'm the editor of that. And that's about the intersection of brand marketing and demand marketing, the need, in other words, for both performance and awareness. And you wrote in the first issue a really terrific point of view about thinking beyond, let's call it impressions or the awareness, and how to assess the success of an influencer campaign by looking at different ways of analyzing engagement. So why don't you give us the explanation of that?
I mean, we start any campaign with our clients by creating a strategic brief. And one of the most important pieces of that strategic brief is a real deep dive into what their KPIs are. And so once we figure out what those are, we figure out, okay, what metrics are going to demonstrate that we've succeeded here. So for example, if it's, and certainly for some clients, they want to see impressions, and that's fine. We can get those easily. But let's say we're doing a program around holiday time and there's a food client and they're sharing a recipe that uses their product as an ingredient. If we're doing an Instagram campaign, we might be really interested in showing how many saves that Instagram content got, because that indicates that the people who saw that content not only read it, saw it, got the impression, liked it, but they saved it so that they could go back to it and make that recipe. It's something we never had access to. It's amazing how many metrics we have access to now. But we just would like clients to think a little bit deeper and look closer at campaigns to analyze. You know, an impression is so vague and, yeah. You know, did they really see it or did they not? I mean, coming from the PR space where you multiply everything by three and, I mean, it's such a wishy-washy metric.
Yeah.
It's nice to have something that's more concrete.
That's great. And I think that was really informative. So let me tap your brain for some other points of view. How do you distinguish? We talked about the celebrity versus the influencer. We've talked about micro and nano influencers. How do you identify what to recommend for your clients?
Again, it comes back to those KPIs. So we might have clients who just want to get as much content as possible. Maybe they're new and they want a ton of content that they can repurpose. They want tons of people posting about it. That could be a great nano program. If we have clients who really need clicks, there's ways to get clicks with nanos, but on Instagram, you don't have swipe up. So we probably would start with micro and go up from there.
We should explain that. So
So nano is under 10,000. I'm speaking on Instagram because that's definitely the majority of our programs, although we're on Twitch, TikTok, Facebook, everywhere. But Instagram is the easiest way to explain these tiers. So nano is less than 10,000. So nano, they're small. They tend to have... me too.
Does less than 1,000 count as anything?
That's what
micro
I have.
Micro nano?
900. They don't have that swipe up. Once you hit 10,000 on Instagram, that's the magic number. And in your stories, you can let people swipe up to click to go visit a website. Micro goes from 10,000 to about 90,000. And then macro is 90 to about 250. And then 250K and above is, it's hard to price. Everything's negotiated separately. Mm-hmm. And it's fine. And there's a place for it. But again, we look at what those KPIs are. The big thing to remember is that as you increase in following, the engagement rate goes down dramatically. So like we had a client last week who really wanted macros. I think they wanted 150K following or above. And then they said, and we also want a 10% engagement rate. Very few people, I mean, we're talking unicorns. The average engagement rate for folks at that level of following is more like 1.5%.
Wow.
That said, if engagement's really important, we've done programs with nanos. We had one who once got a 34% engagement rate on her sponsored post.
Wow.
And obviously you can get a lot more nanos for the price of a macro. So it sometimes feels like a game of Tetris to me, right? Like how many impressions do we need? How many engagements do we need? Do they need clicks? Yes, no. What kind of paid support can we put behind this? How are we going to target that paid? Is it going to be for engagement? And we have these crazy spreadsheets to help us do the math to figure out how to put the program.
Oh, super interesting. I learned a lot just now. I'm going to cite this again of the continuum. The third issue was about purpose. And I know that there is a definite time and a place for using influencers to align with a brand's purpose. Let's have a conversation about that, because I know that there was a lot of social justice movement in the last year that was also tied to influencers. Do you get involved in things like that as well?
We do, and it's changed a lot for the better, in my opinion, over the last year. When we first started Sway Group, brands did not want influencers to have any point of view about anything at all. So if there was any mention of religion or politics or kind of like the old-fashioned rules about what you don't talk about at the dinner table, they didn't want it in their sponsored content. Over the past year, and some of it was all the social justice movements, which is awesome. I think some of it, though, too, is the increasing importance of Gen Z. they expect all of their brands to have a purpose. They expect to feel aligned with that purpose. They want to know what their brands believe in before they pick a brand. And that kind of combined with all of the movements that were happening, brands now want to know what their influencers believe in, and they want to make sure that they're aligned. It's been a good development. It's just, it's a twist. It's something different. It's not something we ever were looking for before. It's kind of nice. I mean, influencers have more engagement when they're vulnerable and are authentic and are sharing themselves. And if you can't talk about any of these really deeply personal things, how can you truly be vulnerable and be your true self? It's hard.
Yeah. And I think that your point about Gen Z being all in on so many social justice issues is perfectly in tandem with their higher consumption of influencer messages. So that threads the needle really well. How would a brand tactically approach, let's say, using influencer marketing to kind of spotlight their values beyond just, you know, that mac and cheese example? What's an example of, well, if Kraft had a value that they wanted to communicate versus their packaged goods?
Yeah, I mean, we actually work with a mac and cheese brand called Freak Flag, which is a new organic mac and cheese brand. They have a couple of other products too, but it's all organic and they're sold in Whole Foods. And their brand purpose is very important to them. They are all about not using any extra ingredients beyond what they need to use. Part of their brand purpose, I mean, it sounds silly, but it's having fun and being colorful and being your true self. And that was all part of our brief. And so if you look at the influencers who participated in that program, they all look and feel like the Freak Flag brand. They all eat organic. They shop at Whole Foods. That's what they do. And they're bright and they're colorful and they live their life out loud and they fully feel like that brand. I keep kind of going back to our strategic brief, but that's a big part of it, is for us to understand what that brand's trying to put out there and then making sure we're really matchmakers. So figuring out which influencers are the right fit. Have they talked about this before? Does it make sense with what they do? Is this something that they're going to feel passionate about? Mm-hmm. That's our job, is to find those people and make that fit and put the program together.
It's a great example, and I swear I didn't know that you were going to use the Freak Flag example when I teed you up with mac and cheese. that was not an influencer moment. So how do these things perform, Danielle? You know, is there true value in purpose-driven campaigns?
Yeah, they do great. They perform just as well, if not better, than some of the more standard, I guess you could say, influencer campaigns, but it's kind of becoming part of what we do for almost all brands now.
Who's doing a good job? Name names. I love that.
Another client of ours, Stonyfield, has always done a great job.
The big yogurt company?
The big yogurt company. Ooh. Yeah, they do a great job with that.
How do they do that?
For example, they have a charitable initiative called Stonyfields, because there are a lot of pesticides used, especially on like soccer fields and stuff. And that's not great for kids who are rolling around in the grass and playing soccer. So they have an initiative to try to make over fields so that they're not toxic. And that obviously is very aligned with who they are as a brand. So they did a program with the actor and comedian Adam Scott, and they made a super fun video with him talking to little kids on the soccer field to promote this initiative. And we used influencer to help promote that. We used people who always write about organic and for whom that's very important. We actually did an Earth Day program for them once too, like reusing yogurt containers for fun projects.
And I remember that. Yeah. That was you? Ooh. That's so great. All right. And hence the content studio was born also. You're thinking. You're always thinking. So we talked about finding moms with children 8 to 10 who wet their bed. We talked about like those who let their freak flag fly. How do you find such niche influencers?
Well, some programs are easier than others. We do have
Sounds like it.
We have a network of over 35,000, and certain programs we know we can always find great people within the network. So for these organic food programs, we have enough of them that we have great people. We're always recruiting in moms of babies because they age out, and we know we have a lot of baby-focused clients, and we know we always have to have babies available. But then sometimes we have to go out of network. We did a program for a large e-commerce company. It was for a power tool, and they wanted contractors who are big on Instagram.
That must have been a fun challenge.
Yeah. But we have an influencer management team. So they're in charge of recruiting. They're looking very closely at what proposals we're sending out so that they can be proactive and start to fill in with influencers that we might be needing down the road if we're not strong in that particular area. Mm-hmm. And then they're also the same people who, once we get a program, they will send out that recruitment to our network, go out of network. They do everything they can to get as many applicants as possible. And then they're the ones who are doing that matchmaking to come up with that list of suggested influencers.
I see.
Campaign.
So last couple of questions. As you said, you focus a lot on Instagram. I happen to be working on a conference that's about how TV and podcasting are coming together. So I'm very much in that multi-screen brain right now. I asked you how many podcasts you've been on or how frequently. Is that a space that you're also getting into? Because it seemed burgeoning.
Yeah, I'm a huge podcast fan myself. In fact, my family's always yelling at me because when I'm doing anything around the house, I have my AirPods in listening to a podcast and I don't hear anyone, and they feel sad and lonely and ignored. I love podcasts. We've done a few programs with podcasts. There's a smallish podcast network called Life Listened that has a number of podcasts that are a great fit for many of our clients because it's more lifestyle focused. Mm-hmm. So we have done some programs, not enough. What's super interesting to me is that podcasting is so great for bottom of funnel. Consumers are so much more likely to click to buy from a podcast. I mean, we can get people to click if it's work, but we can do it. But influencer has typically lived more top of funnel.
Yeah.
Podcasting, I mean, people love to use those codes. I do it myself, and they, you know, my Brooklinens and my whatever, like you hear about it on the podcast. So we talk to our clients about it a lot. We haven't done as many podcasting campaigns as I would like to. It's all something, right. Well, I'm passionate about it. I'd love to do more of it.
Good. And, you know, I welcome the sponsorship opportunities when you want that micro nano influencer. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I have to remind people that they are welcome to buymeacoffee.com/mossappeal. That and the $5 will go towards my rent. So let's wrap it up with talking a little bit more about my favorite area, podcasting. What are your favorite shows and what kind of content are you consuming personally, books, podcasts, TV shows, so that you stay current?
The podcast I listen to most frequently, for sure, is Armchair Expert. Oh, they drive me crazy half the time.
Yeah.
But they have such great guests on, and I just love right. listening to the conversations. I listen to How I Built This all the time.
Uh-huh.
Old school podcasts. I love Fresh Air. And then I am the worst nonfiction reader. I do not enjoy reading nonfiction, which is, I feel terrible as a CEO to say that. I love murder mysteries and beach. I just finished that summer the new Jennifer Weiner book, which is a great beach read.
She's prolific. Well, that's good because we're getting into summer. So that's a really good recommendation. And maybe I can get it as an audio book.
Yeah.
The best of both worlds. All right. Yeah. Danielle Wiley, or as I like to call you, Danielle Sway.
Danielle Sway or PW. I'll answer to anything.
What an informative and influential conversation. This was awesome. Thank you so much for stopping by before you depart for Michigan.
Off.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me. And I feel like I'm so scattered this week. And you can't see it, but there's boxes all around me. So
wow,
hopefully I was coherent.
I'd hate to talk to you on a good day. You would leave me in the dust. Thanks, Danielle.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you got some good insider scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. If you enjoyed this content, please feel free to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/mossappeal. And I hope you'll follow Insider Interviews on social media and let me know if you have a question or a suggestion for a next stellar guest in media, marketing, and advertising. Speaking of stellar, my theme music was composed and performed by the incomparable Grammy-winning John Clayton. If I can help you with your company's podcast, please find me at mossappeal.com. Thanks again for listening.